Om Ratnasambhava, Buddha of beauty and delight. I pay homage to you and worship you. Your body is golden yellow, shining bright. Your right hand is extended in the gesture of supreme generosity. Your left hand holds the wish-fulfilling gem, many-colored, sparkling light. Your lotus throne is borne on the backs of four great golden stallions of the sky. You are a light in darkness, the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Om Ratnasambhava, bestower of gifts, I bow before you in homage and worship. The wish-fulfilling gem in your lap grants all skillful wishes. Your right hand touches the earth and it comes alive, giving unceasingly to all who need. Benign and bountiful, you shower the world with precious gifts. Om Ratnasambhava, Buddha of the glorious southern realm, in homage I prostrate myself at your feet. The midday sun shines through your body as the wisdom of equality, which is your consort, Mamiki, she who sees all beings as her very own, her children, and thus transforms the skanda of feeling into great love and compassion for all beings whatsoever in the universe. Om Ratnasambhava, jewel-born one, my heart sings your praises, homage to you. You enter the human realm, bearing the greatest of all gifts, the most precious threefold gem, Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, that we may have a refuge in this and future lifetimes. Om Ratnasambhava, beautifier of the world, I offer myself to your jeweled shrine. You are beauty and light, laughter and smiles. Your tears are tears of joy, your speech a song of praise. Your wisdom sees the gem of truth in the heart of every being. Your compassion, like a mother's love, shines equally on all your children. You are the diamond in the rock, the gold in the mountain, the treasure beneath the sea. Om Ratnasambhava, Buddha of beauty, of the glorious southern realm, jewel-born, bestower of gifts, all praise to you. May all aspiring wishes be granted. May all beings be happy. So I wrote those verses 27 years ago on my ordination retreat, just before I was ordained. And, well, they're quite devotional, and devotional to Ratnasambhava. And I was given the Ratnasambhava meditation practice at my ordination. But in a way, it's quite mysterious. It's quite mysterious to me why I've come to have this association with Ratnasambhava, why I've got this relationship, I suppose, with Ratnasambhava. Ratnasambhava is obviously part of a very rich symbolism of Vajrayana Buddhism, part of that rich symbolism of the mandala of the five Buddhas, which we'll be hearing about all of this autumn. And the mandala isn't just the Buddhas, but all of the figures associated with the Buddhas. In fact, the mandala seems like a kind of attempt to almost organize some of the symbolism of the Tantra. So my association with Ratnasambhava began very simply. It began with something I read, and it wasn't something I read about Ratnasambhava. It was something I read about Mamaki. So each of the Buddhas in the mandala are associated with a female figure, which represents the wisdom aspect. When they're together in the Yabhyum posture, the female figure represents the wisdom aspect and the male figure represents the compassion. And I read something about Mamaki, the consort or the female figure associated with Ratnasambhava. And it was reading that, that for whatever reason, immediately created a connection with Ratnasambhava for me. And after that, I just had lots of spontaneous images coming up in meditation of Ratnasambhava to such an extent that in the end I couldn't quite avoid it, if you see what I mean. So I ended up taking this practice at my ordination. So I'm going to talk this evening about Ratnasambhava. I'm going to just try and explain some of the symbolism of Ratnasambhava. It's, as I said, it's a very rich and intricate symbolism. It has all sorts of connection with the connections of the whole language of symbolism of the Tantra, as it were. It's as if our minds have a deep pattern of wholeness, you could say, which is not fully expressible in words and concepts and so on. But images and symbols are able to embody and communicate at deeper and deeper levels. Deeper levels of integration and awareness. So the images and the symbolism are able to communicate or express something more than we can access with words and concepts. And therefore, when we come into relationship with those symbols, that symbolism, sometimes what happens is mysterious to us because it's accessing or connecting with parts of us that we're not necessarily fully conscious of all the time. And the images of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they give expression to the highest states of consciousness, the most awakened states of consciousness possible. Each Buddha and each Bodhisattva expresses in symbolic form the whole of the enlightened experience, or they give symbolic expression to the enlightened mind, or what enlightenment is. But each one also emphasizes an aspect of enlightenment, or an aspect of the Buddha mind, or an aspect of the enlightened mind. So each figure speaks to us individually in different ways because of this emphasis on some aspect. But at the same time, they're a complete symbolic communication and embodiment of enlightenment. So Ratnasambhava is one of the Buddhas of Mandala, as I said. And that whole mandala of the five Buddhas is itself a symbol of enlightened consciousness. It's like we had originally the figure of the Buddha, Shakyamuni, touching the earth or in meditation mudra or whatever. But that wasn't enough, as it were. Out of the meditation experience, visionary experience and so on, we have all of these other, as it were, Buddhas or archetypal Buddhas or symbolic Buddhas arising. And so we've ended up with this mandala of five Buddhas with lots and lots of other figures associated with them. So the whole mandala is a symbol of enlightened consciousness, and each of the five Buddhas is also a complete symbol of enlightenment, but each one emphasizes a particular aspect, except perhaps Vairochana, whom we'll hear more about from Kishvari later in a few months' time. So you've already heard, some of you, about Akshobhya from Jnanashalan a couple of weeks ago, so I don't need to say anything about that. Amitabha is coming up next in 2 or 3 weeks. No, 4 weeks. Amitabha is the red Buddha, emphasizes tranquility and love and depth and so on, and a wisdom that sees uniqueness. Amoghasiddhi, the green Buddha, will come up after that, emphasizing courage, fearlessness, confidence, compassionate action and so on. So Ratnasambhava is in colour is yellow or golden yellow, sometimes we say, and the figure of Ratnasambhava emphasises generosity, emphasises beauty, emphasises expansiveness, abundance, richness, things like that. And the wisdom associated with Ratnasambhava is the wisdom that sees how all beings are the same in their depths, as it were. I'll talk a bit more about that later. So the image of Ratnasambhava is an image of a Buddha seated in a full lotus posture, sitting on a white moon disc, which is in the center of a yellow lotus, or a golden yellow lotus. And the lotus throne, as it were, is supported on the backs of four golden yellow horses. And Ratnasambhava's body is made of golden yellow light, and he's wearing richly embroidered robes. His right hand is resting on his right knee, and it's in the gesture of generosity, the Varada Mudra, the gesture of supreme generosity. And his left hand is resting in his lap, and in his left hand there's a jewel, sort of resting in his lap, palm facing upwards, and there's a jewel, a shining jewel in his left hand. His hair is blue-black, he's smiling compassionately, and around his head there's an aura of green light, and around his body an aura of blue light. And as I said, he's associated with these qualities of giving, richness, abundance, expansiveness, beauty, creativity even, and this the wisdom of equality. So I'm just going to draw out some of this symbolism in more detail, draw out its significance, and possibly its significance for a life of spiritual commitment. So I'm going to work from the bottom up, and I'll begin with the horses. So horses were a symbol of wealth. Obviously, certainly in nomadic culture like Tibet, horses are a symbol of wealth. But also in ancient India. In fact, I just saw something on the telly recently about portraiture related to power. You know, queens and kings often had portraits painted of themselves or whatever. But apparently there came a point in, I can't remember whether it was 18th or 19th century, when very rich families had portraits of their horses, or the whole walls of their houses were covered in pictures of their horses, because the horse was a status symbol and a symbol of wealth. Probably still is, in a way. A bit like owning a BMW or whatever the equivalent is. So the horse is a symbol of wealth, and of course Ratnasambhava is associated with spiritual richness and an attitude of abundance and generosity. So the horses became a symbol of that. But the horse is not—that's not the only symbolism, as well. The horses are also, you could say, more psychologically, they symbolise these natural animal energies, as it were, which are gathered together, integrated and focused, so that they become supportive of spiritual endeavour and spiritual experience. So these energies are gathered and integrated and focused. Energies which otherwise would be expended in craving or aversion or whatever. They're sublimated and channeled until they're no longer a hindrance, but a help or a support to spiritual efforts. So to put it more simply, the ill will, resentment, ignorance, pride, greed, and so on, these are what we transform. So we transform our energies into something more positive. And this transformation, you could say, is symbolized by the horses. They're steadily supporting the throne of Ratnasambhava. So the horses are the fully integrated energy that supports spiritual insight, as it were. They're ready for that. I've got a poem here. I don't know whether to read it to you or not. It's just about horses. I'll read it to you anyway. Yeah. It's a poem by Pablo Neruda, Chilean poet. Caballos, horses. I just like the poem because it brings out something of this energy of horses. Yeah? So maybe you like it. I saw horses from the window. I was in Berlin in winter. The light was without light, the sky without sky. The air white like soaked bread. And from my window I saw a desolate arena, bitten by the teeth of winter. Suddenly, conducted by one man, 10 horses stepped out of the fog. Gently wavering, they emerged like flames. Yet for my eyes they filled the whole world, empty until this hour. perfect burning. They were like 10 gods on large, chaste hooves with manes like the dream of salt. Their rumps were whorls and oranges. Their colour was honey, amber, blazing. Their necks were towers cut from the stone of pride. And energy like a prisoner rose up in their furious eyes. And there, in silence, in the middle of the day, in a dirty and dishevelled winter, the intense horses were the blood, the rhythm, the inciting treasure of life. I looked and looked and so returned to life, not knowing there was the fountain, the dance of gold, the sky, the fire that lives in beauty. I have forgotten that dark Berlin winter. I shall not forget the light of those horses. So this beautifully evoked something of horses for me. When I read that first, I thought, yes, those are Ratnasambhava's horses. Yeah. So beneath the lotus, you could say, is in terms of the symbolism, what's underneath the lotus is mundane. It's not a transcendental level of it doesn't go beyond self, as it were. So the lotus symbolizes the transition from the mundane to the transcendental, the transition from the selfish in all its subtlety to the selfless in all its sublimity. So the horses represent the highest of mundane consciousness, this great concentration of energies, which is sufficient to enable a breakthrough into an altogether different level of consciousness. Pablo Neruda talks about them as intense, the intense horses. So it's like this intense energy. Bhante talks about how we need intensity in our spiritual life. If it's going to be strong enough to take us beyond our ego identity, there needs to be a certain intensity, by which he means that we need to have quite a lot of focused energy on our practice. So the horses represent that, and altogether, yes, integrated experience. So the mundane experience of life is an experience that's filtered through a narrow sense of self, a sense of I and mine, a sense of possessiveness, defensiveness, fear, insecurity, pride, status seeking, and so on. So that's what we're working with. That's the raw material of our spiritual practice, as it were. The fully awakened consciousness, on the other hand, is free of insecurity, free of status seeking, free of any sense of possessiveness or defensiveness, and so on, free of all sense of I or mine. And in between these two, the mundane and the fully awakened consciousness, there's a whole spectrum of relatively more awakened or more transcendent states. And various Buddhist traditions refer to these in different ways. So for instance, in the Theravadan tradition, we have this sequence of the stream entrant and the once-returner and the non-returner and the arahant. So it's a sequence of different levels of attainment, as it were. Or in the Mahayana, there's the Bodhisattva path and the bhumis, the 10 bhumis of the Bodhisattva path. Or in our own tradition, Bhante talks about levels of going for refuge, provisional going for refuge, effective going for refuge, real going for refuge, and absolute going for refuge. So, practically speaking, it's probably best that we see this as a kind of continuum from a relatively self-centered state of consciousness or awareness to a more and more expansive state of awareness. And the more expansive state is of awareness is equally concerned with self and others, and more able to relate to the spiritual potential of others, rather than just to their personalities or their usefulness. I was talking this morning with our centre team about this, how often how we relate to each other is in terms of either what we do, so our use, as it were, in the world, our usefulness, our utility, or in terms of personality, what we're like, as it were. But actually, in terms of relating to each other spiritually, we have to go beyond both usefulness and personality. Personality is really not very useful in terms of relating to people, because personalities are often, they don't change very much, yeah? You know, if we get caught up or caught with relating to personalities, we can get stuck in a rut of communicating in a particular way. What we're trying to do in terms of spiritual practice is we're trying to be in contact with our own spiritual aspiration, in contact with that what's deeply meaningful for us, and relating from that and relating to that in other people. As much as we're able to. And it's not an easy task. Our default is to relate in terms of personality or usefulness. That's what we'll find ourselves defaulting to often. But what we're trying to do is to relate both to ourselves and to others in terms of something more in what our values are about. Why did I just say that? That was to do with, there's a continuum of spiritual, a continuum of consciousness, as it were, and we're trying to move out of this kind of more, as it were, mundane consciousness that's just relating to ourselves, initially, and to others, in terms of our personality or our usefulness. So the lotus, moving on to the lotus, so we've got the horses supporting the lotus throne, and the lotus can be seen to represent this continuum of awareness, which is what the spiritual path really is. So we've got different metaphors. We've got a metaphor of the path, obviously goes from A to B. The trouble with the metaphor of the path, of course, is that we can envisage ourselves on a path, but it's the same me on the beginning of the path, on the end of the path. The lotus, in some ways, is a better symbol, because if you, as it were, envisage yourself as a lotus grows and it changes. So it's not you on the path, you are the lotus, or you are the path, if you are. You're the one that's growing and changing, opening and expanding and so on. So this metaphor of the lotus is an image for growth in awareness and compassion that gradually becomes awakening into reality. So in the middle of the lotus, as I said, there's this moon mat. So it's a moon or a moon disc of brilliant white light. And you could say this represents the purity at the heart of the awakening mind. And this perfect purity or perfect morality is associated in the Theravadin scheme with the non-returner. So we could see the horses as representing something like the highest dhyanic states of consciousness, the states that you reach in meditation of dhyana, and the lotus representing something like insight into the nature of reality, insight or stream entry or knowledge and vision of things as they are and so on. And the moon mat is a stage slightly further on from that. So you can see the whole thing is like a kind of spiral path in symbolic form, gradually, or like the, I don't know how many of you come across the image of the stupa, where you've got the more solid or less changeable elements at the bottom, and gradually it becomes more and more refined going up. So it's a similar kind of idea with the Buddha image and the symbolism of the Buddha image. So, of course, purity is associated for us with ethics, with observing ethical principles in all aspects of our lives and in more and more subtle ways. So we pursue this process of purification, and it can continue for a long, long time, as we're burning up more and more of the the scattered debris of our unskillfulness. It involves obviously confession and involves rejoicing in our merits and our aspirations and so on. And in order to purify our minds, we have to follow the Buddha's practice. What the Buddha did is he just tried to be aware of skillfulness and unskillfulness, and tried to be aware of which mental states were skillful and which were unskillful. This is what he talks about in one of the suttas. He talks about this is what he did before he was enlightened. He just looked at the skillfulness and the unskillfulness of his mental states. And of course, meditation enables us to, as it were, slow down enough and become aware enough to be able to notice the tendency of our minds. And obviously when we find our mind tending in the unskillful direction, we have to remind ourselves of our higher aspirations, our higher values, and the attitudes and so on that characterize a purified and skillful mind. Sometimes we have to look deeper into the roots of our unskillfulness. We have to look at what's behind it, because what we're manifesting, as it were, in terms of our behaviour may be to do with something else that's hidden even to us, as it were. So for instance, our anger might be based on hidden fears or something like that. So sometimes we have to investigate more deeply. But one of the things I was reflecting on is that actually often we do notice more our unskillfulness, and we can notice anger, and we can notice greed, and we can notice these things. But we also need to be aware of our skillfulness and need to try and notice when we're experiencing kindness and love and metta and generosity and impulses to give and be expansive and be in relation with others and so on. Because sometimes we almost like ignore those things because we're so concentrated or so focused on trying to change ourselves or change what's maybe not so, we don't like about ourselves or is not so good about us or whatever. But one of the ways, of course, of one way of changing those things is to focus on them and try and change them. Another way is to focus on what's really positive in ourselves and allow that to grow. And then, again, using the metaphor of something growing, you nourish what you want to grow. You nourish those seeds. You pour the water of your awareness onto them so that they grow. But if we reflect deeply on our ethical practice, on our states of mind, skillful, unskillful, and so on, the states of mind behind our behavior, and so on, if we reflect deeply in that way, our ethical practice starts to become more of an insight practice, more of an insight into the kind of ego identity that's lying behind the unskillfulness, if you see what I mean. Yes, so if we look deeply enough, gradually what we uncover is the kind of existential insecurity and the constructed ego identity that lie behind our responses to the world and our responses to other people. So we can look at ethical practice as a path towards insight, a path into insight into the nature of reality, as it were. Okay, so I got as far as the moon disc. So Ratnasambhava sits on the moon disc, and his body, as I said, is made of golden yellow light. So golden yellow is a very rich, vibrant colour. And this, of course, continues the theme of richness and abundance associated with Ratnasambhava. It's the colour of ripeness, of harvest, the fruits of the earth, and so on. It's the colour most associated with the sun at its brightest. So it's the colour of life, you could say. It's the colour of aliveness. And Ratnasambhava is intensely alive. You could say this is awakened consciousness being shown at its most vibrantly alive. It's the most vibrantly alive we can be, bursting with the light of wisdom and drawing that light and life out of others. So not just causing, you could say, causing growth and ripening in others. So if we wanted to talk about this in terms of practice, you could say that a golden yellow represents the practice of encouraging. It's seeing the seeds of wisdom and compassion in ourselves and others and encouraging them to grow and ripen. So Ratnasambhava is the great encourager. And this whole symbolism of richness and abundance and generosity is encouraging. You could say it's coaxing the best out of us. It's encouraging the little seedlings of goodwill and affection and loving kindness and so on to grow into fully blossoming wisdom and compassion. And so the colour yellow, in a way, evokes the wisdom of equality. And the wisdom of equality is this particular wisdom that's associated with Ratnasambhava. There are five wisdoms, this one associated with each of the Buddhas. And the wisdom of equality is a very heightened awareness of the spiritual potential of all living beings. If you have a heightened awareness of the spiritual potential of others, then you regard them all as equally important, equally valuable, and you treat them with equal kindness, equal consideration. And as I think probably with all of the wisdoms associated with the mandala, when you look closely, you see that wisdom is compassion. So you could just as well probably talk about the five compassions as the five wisdoms. So this is compassion in the sense of maha karuna, the great compassion. It's the response of a Buddha to deluded beings. So sometimes you might think of compassion as a response to suffering, a kindly and helpful response to physical or emotional pains in other people. But the great compassion, the maha karuna, is a response to the existential pain of deluded beings. It's a response to the suffering caused by spiritual ignorance. So the Buddha's compassion goes towards all unenlightened beings, regardless of whether they themselves realize that they are suffering. For example, in the Tibetan Wheel of Life, in that imagery, you've got the realm of the gods. The gods are not suffering in any way, really. But the Buddha is there depicted as playing the music of impermanence to the gods. So that's the Buddha's gift, as it were, or teaching to the gods. The gods don't know they're suffering necessarily, but from the perspective of the Buddha, they are. Perhaps they don't even want to be reminded of impermanence, but nevertheless, that's what's happening. So Ratnasambhava's wisdom, this wisdom of equality, the Samatthanjana, is also the wisdom that sees clearly the sameness of all beings, in that all beings live within the same reality. The same reality applies to all beings. We could talk about as the reality of paticca-samuppada, the reality of the law of conditionality. So paticca-samuppada is the reality that everything in the entire universe arises in dependence upon conditions, and therefore all beings physically and mentally arise in dependence upon conditions, and all of the conditions are interlinked. Actually, I shouldn't say Pratityasamutpada is the reality. Pratityasamutpada is a conceptualized expression of the reality. It's a kind of conceptual symbol of a reality, and that reality, that's how it's expressed in words, as it were. What the actual reality is experientially is something else. So it's this reality that everything depends on conditions, a whole multiplicity of conditions, and all of those conditions are interlinked. So all beings are part of the conditions in dependence upon which all beings arise. So there are no beings who do not arise in dependence upon conditions. And there are no beings who are not conditions for the arising of other phenomena. So because we inhabit a world of beings, we're totally interconnected and interdependent. And therefore, we're fundamentally, you could say, the same. So the wisdom of equality sees and experiences this, and sees it and experiences it so deeply that the only possible response is compassion. There's something a bit similar to this, I seem to remember, in the Bodhicharya Avatara, which some of you will be familiar with, where Shantideva talks about how we regard our own limbs, our own arms and legs and so on, as parts of the body. We're not alienated from them. We don't think of them as something separate. And he encourages us to regard all beings as like limbs of the universe, that we're all arms and legs of the universe, as it were, and that therefore we're all, you know, the one being in a sense, and we should have that compassion, the same as what compassion you would have for your own hand or your own leg, you have for other beings. So the hands of Ratnasambhava. So the right hand, as I said, is extended in this mudra, this gesture of giving, generosity, supreme giving. And of course, this symbolizes this continuous flow of generosity or compassion towards all beings. And that continuous flow is a visible manifestation of the awakened mind. The awakened mind that's seen deeply into the truth of dependent arising. And so the visible expression of seeing into that truth is this continuous flow of generosity or compassion. And the left hand of Ratnasambhava, resting in his lap, holds this radiant jewel. A jewel rests in his hand. The jewel is yet another symbol of the enlightened mind. It's precious, it's invaluable, it radiates light in all directions. Sometimes it's spoken of as the wish-fulfilling gem, or the wish-fulfilling jewel, the jewel that grants all skillful wishes. So these two hands taken together of Ratnasambhava, they form a symbolism of the internal and the external, of stillness and activity, the fullness of being overflowing into the fullness of giving. So you've got the fullness of being of the jewel overflowing into the fullness of giving of the Varada Mudra. So this is a kind of unification of opposites, or at least what can seem to be opposites from an unawakened perspective. And again, you find this symbolism occurring very often with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, this unification of opposites. So we may tend to swing between withdrawal into stillness, followed by activity or a focus on inner life or the inner world, followed by a focus on the external world, or a concern with self, followed by concern with others. But this symbolism, which, as I say, is repeated again and again in lots of different images, this symbolism is telling us that these seeming opposites can be united, need to be united, and will be united if we continue to progress spiritually. So we learn to be still in the midst of activity, to be aware of others and the external world without losing awareness of self. And we come to experience for ourselves this sense of abundance and richness that's not depleted by giving. It's the opposite. It's enriched by giving. So we come to experience that sense of abundance that's enriched rather than depleted by giving. So the two hands of Ratnasambhava form a kind of a circle, an endless flow of energy, an endless flow of compassion, a mind purified and manifesting in compassionate activity, and a compassionate activity enhancing the purity of the awakened mind. So it's a virtuous circle, you could say. Yeah. So taken altogether, this symbolism of Ratnasambhava is all about expanding awareness in every direction. It's about including everything in awareness. Or to put that a bit more mystically, it's about expanding the mind, expanding consciousness, until the mind and the universe coincide, become synonymous. And what that means, I think, on a more everyday, a more down-to-earth level, is mindfulness. Mindfulness, you could say, is a key practice in Buddhism. In the teaching that many of you will know of the five spiritual faculties, you've got wisdom and faith, and you've got energy and meditation, balancing each other. But the fifth factor, the one that holds it all together, is mindfulness. It's the balancing faculty, as it were, because you can't with any of the other things, wisdom or faith or meditation or energy, it's possible to go too far in one direction. It's possible to expend put too much of yourself into energy or into meditation or into faith or whatever, but it's not possible to do that with mindfulness. Mindfulness is an endless practice, as it were. So what we're aiming for is this, an interconnected mindfulness, being aware of ourselves, our thoughts, our emotions, words, actions, and so on, and aware of other people in the same way, aware of our environment, objects, space, light, colour around us, and so on. One of the things I've found doing meditating on a Buddha like this is it makes you very aware of particular colours, if I'm meditating on a green figure, I become very aware of green in the environment and so on. With Ratnasambhava, it's always yellow and gold and things like that. So yes, an interconnected awareness. We need even to try to be aware of reality, aware of impermanence, aware of the unsatisfactoriness of worldly things and the higher truth represented by the Buddha. And our awareness in all of these areas needs to be interconnected. We need to be aware of how everything affects everything else, how everything is always part of the conditions for something else. So it's almost as if we need to, in order to become aware like this, we need to ask ourselves questions. We need to be reflecting in a questioning way. Like, how does our environment affect us? By environment, I mean even the room that you're sitting in, as it were. How does it affect you? What effect do other people have on us? Even more importantly, what effect do we have on other people? In what way does reality impact on us? In what way does reality impact on our environment or on other people? I mean, reality, how do we relate to reality? It might be that we think of impermanence or something like that, but whatever it is that we think of, in what way does it impact on us? What is the effect of the potential for awakening on our lives? So there's this potential for awakening, a potential for enlightenment, or a potential for spiritual growth, which probably all of us here in this room are aware of to some degree or other through practicing meditation, through trying to be ethical and so on. In what way does that really, what effect does it really have on us? And so asking ourselves questions like this and reflecting in this way, we can develop a kind of interconnected awareness, which is an essential basis for awakening. And this symbolism of Ratnasambhava is encouraging this kind of interconnected awareness. So when we take our awareness deeper into ourselves and further out into the world around us, the promise, as it were, is that we'll experience great beauty and access to energy that's always flowing out into generous activity. So this interconnected awareness is alive, it's rich, it's abundant. In symbolic terms, it's golden yellow. It's a sun that gives warmth and nourishment everywhere. It gives warmth and nourishment everywhere equally and encourages us to grow and to emerge from the solid earth of our mundane, egoistic selves. So Ratnasambhava is known as the Buddha of generosity, and he's also known as the Buddha of beauty. So what is beauty as an aspect of the enlightened mind? The beautiful mind, you could say, or the mind of beauty, is the mind which sees and experiences everything from a non-utilitarian perspective. It's an aesthetic appreciation rather than a consideration of usefulness. We're going to be looking at this next month. We're going to have, we haven't advertised it yet, but there's going to be an urban retreat here. And the whole theme is the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. So we'll be looking at this whole question about beauty as opposed to usefulness. In his book, Living Ethically, Bhante talks a bit about this. He says, the Buddha remarks more than once in the Pali scriptures that a sign or characteristic of metta is that you see things as beautiful, shupa. This is because the key element of both shupa and metta, which raises them above ordinary human emotion, is disinterested awareness, a pure delight in the object for its own sake. And then he goes on to say, the aesthetic attitude is one that sees everything, including other people, with a warm and clear awareness and appreciates things just as they are, without thinking how they could be improved or put to some use. So our unawakened perspective is often materialistic and utilitarian in relation to the rest of the world. We tend to want to possess or accumulate whatever enhances our sense of self, and we don't want to exclude what threatens our ego identity. The attitude of beauty excludes nothing. And this brings back to the wisdom of equality, which is represented, as I said earlier, by Mamaki, the consort of Ratnasambhava. Mamaki is known as the my maker or mind maker, in the sense that she makes everything her own. Nothing is excluded, and there's no grasping and no aversion. So what does that mean for us? We're engaged in this project of awakening, you could say, awakening to reality, the spiritual life. And one way of thinking about that, what we're doing, one way of thinking about it is that we're trying to become bigger. We're trying to expand and develop an awareness that misses nothing and that denies nothing. We're trying to develop an attitude that doesn't condemn or praise what arises in our own minds, at least not too quickly. We accept what arises, reflect deeply on it, and rely on the transforming power of awareness in alliance with our spiritual aspirations. And our spiritual aspiration is the context of all our practice. We usually talk about this as faith or Shraddha in Sanskrit. And because of our spiritual aspirations, we're able to distinguish between skillful and unskillful mental states. And our task is to bring awareness to all mental states equally so that they can all be transformed towards the skillful. So, not so far to go. The auras around the body of Ratnasambhava. I mentioned there are two auras. There's the aura of green light around his head and blue light around his body. They symbolize the effects of the process of the accumulation of merit and wisdom. So when we're skillful in our actions, in our speech and in our thoughts, it's as if we create a field of influence around us, an aura which has an effect on others. So the green aura around the head of Ratnasambhava represents the accumulation of wisdom, and the blue aura around his body represents the accumulation of merit. And this word accumulation, it often is the word used, and you find it in pujas and all sorts of things, the accumulation of merit and wisdom. And this word accumulation indicates that this is a process. The arising of insight into the nature of reality is a process. Awakening is a process. The building up of purity of mind and merit, which enables us to be compassionate, is also a process. Our spiritual life is a process of unfolding like the leaves of the lotus unfold, or like the lotus grows out of the mud. In the Dhammapada, they use a slightly different image. It says, "Do not underestimate the good, thinking it will not approach me. A water pot becomes full by the constant falling of drops of water. Similarly, the wise man, little by little, fills himself with good." So I hope I've managed to convey something of the meaning of Ratnasambhava, maybe the spirit of Ratnasambhava. What I'd like to do is finish a little bit like I started. I'd like to read something kind of devotional. This is a prayer to Ratnasambhava. And again, it's something I wrote to myself many years ago. I can't remember how many. So I'm just going to finish off with this. Often I find with these figures, we can talk about them and I can try and explain the symbolism. But actually, in the end, we have to just relate to them, because we're relating to symbolism. We have to relate to the symbolism of colour. We have to relate to the symbolism of form, of gesture, and so on. In the end, it isn't really... The explanation is just a way of slightly opening a door on something that then, you know, it's like opening a door in front of maybe a painting or something like that. And then you have to stand and look at it or engage with it or whatever. Yeah, you have to enter into relationship. Yeah, or another way of putting it is that what I've been trying to do is introduce you to Ratnasambhava. I'm saying, here's Sarah, Ratnasambhava, introduced, yes? And then the two of them have to talk to each other if they want to. Yeah. Okay. Om Ratnasambhava Trung, Buddha of beauty in the glorious southern realm, may you fill my heart with the spirit of generosity and the light of wisdom. May the wisdom of equality pervade my being, like a beautiful fragrance, shedding delight and joy wherever I go. May I be beautiful in thought, word and deed, a messenger of happiness in a suffering world. May I have the strength and conviction to be always kind and loving, and may I be free from fear and hatred. May I radiate the light of compassion which enters my heart through your great bounty. May all those I meet on my path through life benefit from their contact with me. May I pass on the richness and abundance flowing through me from my contact with you. May the exuberance and rapture of your wisdom endow the world with an exultant pleasure in rejoicing and singing. May words of praise and generous thoughts and acts of kindness abound everywhere, and may no one suffer through the cruelty of his or her fellow humans. May all that oppresses us and brings fear to our hearts be dissolved in the great power of your smiling compassion. May we love each other with a passion greater than our desire for life, and may we protect each other as parents protect their children. May our prayers for peace be rewarded with a change of heart from those who purvey war and violence. May all living creatures live out their lives and gain satisfaction from their period alive, however short a span. May all who practice Dharma be successful, and may the veils of ignorance which cloud our vision slowly drop away to reveal the wisdom which embraces all worlds and is beyond the power of speech. May our hearts be open, may our minds be open, may our arms be open, and may love radiate from us like the rays of the sun, bringing warmth and light into every cold and dark corner and lightening the burden of our fellow creatures. May our finest dreams come true. May our enemies become our friends. May all boundaries and divisions collapse in the face of the wisdom of equality and the unutterable compassion of Ratnasambhava.